Okay, so this is another interview with Manual Therapy Blog, and today we have Professor Laurie Hartman, who's an osteopath from England. He is a graduate from the British School of Osteopathy in 1964, and in, I believe, 1999, you earned the title Professor. Laurie, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. I'm very glad to be associated.
Laurie, I just wanted to let listeners know how I first heard about you. I was in residency for my manual physical therapy, and I first heard about you from my mentor at the time. He was remarking about your technique and your skill, and certainly what great hands you had. Could you please tell us a little bit more about yourself, you know, where you grew up or how you became interested in osteopathy?
Yeah, originally I wanted to do medicine, but in those days you needed Latin to do medicine. I hadn't done that. So then I had a bad back myself when I was at school. My parents took me to their osteopath, who then sorted me out. And he was a spiritualist, and he said, you should be an osteopath. Well, I thought about it, and then I thought, well, so I went to the School of Osteopathy, and they interviewed me and said, right, you're in. So at 16, I was in the college, and it was a brand new course, 4 years, and at 20, I was qualified. I was already teaching because I knew what I was doing, and that's how I got into being an osteopath. So at 20, I was qualified. I was working on people up to the age of 30, and they were all older than me because this happened. And my skill developed over a period of time. I was very good at manipulation straight away because I watched what they were doing and that worked. And I had a lot of experience in practice over the years till I sold my practice. I had 60,000 patients, a load of patients and loads of practice. And I started working an hour and then 40 minutes, then 30 minutes, eventually 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that was effective. And the shortest time I spent on people, the less reactions they got. And this is what I'm trying to tell people.
Yeah.
So that's a very brief history. But any questions you want to ask?
Well, how did you get into the BSO at 16 years old? How did that work out?
The school was mostly for A-level people, which is in England you do O-levels at 16, A-levels at 18. And it was mostly for A-level people. But they introduced an extra year. They turned out from 3 years to four. And I was the second year I was in. So I got in at 16 because they did the sciences internally. So I was the youngest one ever qualified, actually.
Wow.
Which was interesting.
And then you started teaching right away at 20 years old?
Well, I was teaching before that because my year was only 16 people. Now there's 120 in a year.
Yeah.
And I was helping people develop because they couldn't do it. And I was only, 18, 19, and mm-hmm. I was already teaching. So as soon as I qualified, I went into teaching as well as starting a practice.
Wow. So what was it about you that, if you could think about it and let us know, what was it about you that seemed to grasp the manual technique so easily? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. It was something that I had straight away. They showed me a technique, providing I could get the hold, I could usually get something to work pretty well. I was using a lot of force, but it worked.
Mm.
And gradually the force has reduced over the years.
Yeah, that's one thing that is a hallmark of your technique now is how little force that you have to use, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what were some of your main mentors in school or even after school?
My main mentors were people like Tommy Hall, who qualified in Kirksville, and then he came to England and carried on working there.
Hmm.
And Middleton, who was the similar age. He was 72 when he died. But he was also a very good manual manipulator. It was him that started the system that I'm using of manual therapy using minimal leverage.
Oh, okay. So that's not something that you came up with.
No, it was him beforehand. I've developed it, but he was the guy that started that.
Okay. So how are they mentors to you? In what ways were they mentoring you?
They could manipulate anything with sufficient force that it worked. And they were both very gentle with their approach. They were tough if they had to be, but usually very little force. Everything was just right, a little push and everything would go. And we at the old school of osteopathy, they had the technique rooms were upstairs. And one of them, I was working with other people, and I had a second rib. It's given me a lot of problems. And Hall came in. We were supposed to be doing thoracolumbar. He came in, "What are you doing with that?" And he said, "Oh, well, he's got a second rib." And he literally got hold of it with two hands and just pulled it down, said, "Right, that's freed it. Now do something. Now do what you're supposed to do." I've never been able to do that. He just grabbed it and it freed. Now, I know as a student, I was only 18, and it was very easy to do, but I've never managed to do it. He had an amazing skill.
Wow. So since you've been around such amazing people with amazing skill, what do you think, or how do you think they develop that, or what do you think other people could do to develop such skill?
I think in those days you had to be a real fighter. You had to fight very hard because the doctors hated you. If you told your doctor you were going to an osteopath, they would say, "Oh, I'm not going to treat you if you're going there. They injure people." So you had to be a fighter. When I qualified, there was only 256 osteopaths in England. Now there's nearly 6,000.
Wow.
And so if you've been around for a while, which I have, you get good and you stay good, really. Most people pack up by my age, but I'm keeping on because I enjoy it.
Well, I'm sure seeing 60,000 patients over the years helps too.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
So did you have any other influences as a youngster or young person that solidified your decision to become an osteopath other than what... going to your parents' osteopath?
Well, I was very good with hands. At school, which is a long time ago now, I always came to the top in woodwork because I was very precise, and planes and saws and things were normal to me. I used those all the time. So I think that helped. I was also doing a lot of sports with single things like discus and shot put, and I was good at those. And that was precision with the hands. And if you gave me something to work on, I'd take it apart, see how it worked, put it back together. It was something like that developed, I think, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that would certainly make sense. Going back a little bit from what you were saying before, am I correct in what you said that you began your own practice at 20 years old after you qualified?
Yes. Oh, yes. People would come in and they'd say, "Why are you so young?" They were very scared, but when they found they got results, they were perfectly happy.
Yeah, so, and you saw one person per hour at that time, or?
To start with, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
To start with.
That's when I had patients. But fairly quickly, they go away and they say, "I'm better, go and see this guy." Mm-hmm. And people did. And if they got better, they would recommend. So it was all by recommendation. We weren't allowed to advertise in those days. Not at all.
Really?
And it was all by recommendation.
Okay. Yeah. Did you learn anything in those early days that you might have done differently?
Yes. I worked with lots of people as an assistant with Leonard Wardell, who's still in practice. He's 80 plus now.
Wow.
He was very good. I worked with him for a couple of years. With Dr. Barrett, who was a doctor and an osteopath. So he was doing injections and things. I worked with him. And I learned a bit from him. I worked with about five different people in different areas for anything from 3 months up to a couple of years. And everybody I learned from a little. And my own approach got better and better. The biggest change really happened in 1992 when I fell off a roof. I was spraying a wasp nest up a ladder, and for some reason the ladder collapsed. I fell down two stories, landed on my head, smashed the left side of my head, dislocated my shoulder, fractured my spine at T12, fractured four ribs on the left. I was rushed to hospital by helicopter, and they reckoned I wouldn't live. And I did. I came through with help from Stuart Corth, who was a guy working on the cranium. My wife took me to everybody to get better. I went to lots of different therapies, lots of different approaches. And since then, my ability to diagnose, just putting my hand on, has improved dramatically. And my skill has improved as well. I don't recommend other people go and do that, but in my case, it made a big difference.
Yeah, certainly. So, well, thank you for bringing that up. I was going to ask you about that, if you didn't mind.
No.
Because I've, for listeners out there, I've taken a couple of courses from Lori and actually instigated bringing him to the U.S. a couple years ago for a sort of an in-house course that I set up. But I remember hearing you talk about your accident, and I've heard it in different places before too, how somehow that really was instrumental in changing the gentleness of your technique. Was it just something that just came to you naturally, like you don't know how it changed and how it became so different, or was it something conscious effort on yourself because you were so injured and you didn't want to be as forceful?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think it's a combination of wanting to succeed, not knowing what I did. My wife put my book into the hospital when I was lying there, said, "This is what you did." And I flicked through the pages and it came back suddenly. Everything came back, bang, and I knew what I was doing. Hmm. And she got back into working, which I didn't want to do. And straight away I was better. But the gentleness, I think, is a combination of lots of experience, lots of practice, and being very precise with positioning. I have a colleague in America who's writing a book at the moment, Bill O'Grady, who most people know mm-hmm. in manipulation. He's very good. He was very powerful to start with. And he's been on courses with me, and he's just finishing a book at the moment. And he's got lots of things in there. And he talks about having a sheet of bubble wrap on the table and bursting an individual thing by pressing with your thumb. Mm-hmm. Now, if you try that with your thumb, you've got to put pressure first. That makes a big difference. Most manipulations, you put pressure with both hands. You take hold of it, like holding a live bird mm-hmm. in your hands. You're not squashing it. You're tensing yourself. That makes a big difference, and that I've discovered since. And if I increase the compression people use with themselves, everything works better. Mm-hmm. And if you try bursting a sheet of bubbles and you put pressure first with your thumb, it works better than doing it like that. There's something about that. Now, what exactly is happening, I don't know. But if you try it, you'll feel that that works.
Yeah, well, thank you for that little tidbit. Lori, I've taken manipulation courses from different people over the years in my young career. And one thing strikes me that's different when I went to take a course from you. And so far, you're the only person that's really emphasized body mechanics and body position and just something that seems like it would be fairly basic or instrumental, but you're really the only one that emphasized it. And I wanted to say thank you for that or commend you for that, because right away you set off and talked about different positioning of the feet, of the legs, hands in relation to and body in relation to the patient. So is that a key for you that you've noticed over the years, or is that something that you guys learned in school?
That came from the fact that I studied lots of different sports, but one sport I did study in quite some detail was karate. And this was Shotokan karate, which is Japanese style, very hard, very solid. And I did that for 20 years. I did 10 years of training to get my black belt, and then I went on and got to third level, which is pretty high. I can't do it now, but I used to.
Wow.
And that teaches exact positioning. And if you hit somebody with the right stance, you hurt them. instantly. There's no force. You're just using the control. And that all comes from the back leg. And I suddenly realized after 6 months of doing that, that's exactly the same as what you do when you manipulate. You stand in a certain way and you position yourself. And then I started to look at what we did. And most techniques, you work from the back foot, not the front foot. If you want gentleness, you work from the front foot. And with your head, you don't drop it down. You lift it up. And just literally lifting your head. And that's all from the basic karate stances. It's exactly the same. If you train in judo, karate, anything like that, you're using your posture well. And I think people that have done that automatically have got an advantage. And I've had lots of students who've done that who immediately are that much further on than anybody else.
Well, that's good to know. So we can certainly do something like martial arts instead of falling off a ladder to help our technique.
Oh, I think that's better, yes.
Given how long that you've been an osteopath and seeing patients and even teaching around the world, what still excites you about manual therapy?
About seeing people who haven't the faintest idea and within 2 days are much, much better at what they do and go on learning after that using the same system because they've used that as a starting point.
Wow, okay. And sort of along those same lines, are there any particular things that you hope younger clinicians across different professions for that reason, for that matter, but for younger clinicians that you hope they take away from their time with you?
I think of treating people with respect because they're coming for treatment in England anyway, just wearing the underclothes, they're all nervous. So treating people with respect, touching them in the right way, and then teaching them how little power is necessary. You're not hitting them hard, you're trying to hit them gently. And at first it's very frustrating, it doesn't work, but with practice it does. And you can get amazing results. What I don't know is when somebody else does something, they do it well, and then I come along and I do it, the patient immediately is better. Now, is that me? Is that something I'm doing? Is it something about the confidence that I'm putting over? There's something different. And if people can work on that and work on what they do, that makes an enormous difference.
Well, as you mentioned that, over the years, has there been a lot of introspection or thinking about what you're doing while you're doing it that's allowed you to learn and refine your technique, or is it just that it came natural to you?
I think it came naturally, and it's developed since, and it's still developing. Every course I do, I'm learning things as I'm going along, because somebody's struggling with something, and he just changes his foot position, turning one leg just in a bit, and immediately it's working. And you see that, and you think, and that's helping me to develop. When I'm doing it, I'm doing the same thing. Yeah. I'm constantly open to learn, because if you reckon you've got it, you should be packing up and doing something else, basically.
That's good to hear. So with, correct me if I have the terminology wrong, I know that the minimal leverage terminology is correct, but the component theory is, for manipulation, is that something that is synonymous with minimal leverage?
Well, in minimal leverage, you're using multiple number of components and the minimum quantity of each one. So it's all part of the same. You can't do minimal leverage just by hitting it. You've got to put in the components. I've identified them. And when I identify them accurately, it works. But I'm talking about side bending, rotation, side shifting, extension. And then when I do it, I've got to do it without thinking, because otherwise it doesn't work. You've got to almost feel the tension there. And that's largely a mental thing. You've got to feel your way in.
Can you describe that again for us in just a little bit of detail, what you mean by minimal leverage or component for those listeners who haven't heard of that or taken a course from you yet? Can you describe a little bit more of what that means?
Well, in in the thoracic spine, for example, the dog technique, where the patient folds both arms across the chest, you put one hand underneath and you apply a thrust. Fine. If you lay the patient on the back with their arms folded, you haven't got a hand underneath, and you just push down on the elbows, they can feel tension somewhere in the back. If you push downwards and a little bit leftwards with that right hand underneath, they can feel some tension. If you push down and left and side bend them towards you, they feel a bit more tension. If you push down and left and side bend and then crush them with the other arm to you, they feel that very precisely. If you put one hand underneath now, as you're putting pressure down, you're lifting that hand up. As you're putting pressure and rotation, you're turning it. As you've got pressure and rotation, you're introducing side bending. Everything you're doing with both hands is doing this. Imagine breaking a piece of wood. You put it between the hands, you turn both hands like that. You're not actually turning one hand. And if it doesn't work, bring it close to you. It's better. So this is just identifying what people do. If you're thrusting to the table, it does work, but you can use much more power than thrusting towards the head. So that's taking one illustration. I can show that in seconds, but to talk about it is quite difficult. That's the elements that we're doing.
And could you give an example for like the lumbar spine along the same lines?
Yeah, in the lumbar spine, people push the shoulder back as far as it'll go, take the hip forward and hit the patient hard. That's fine. But if you introduce with that compression down to the table with your arm, you're putting downward pressure. That's part of it. Downward pressure with the upper arm behind the center line on the ribs. That immediately focuses the technique as much as you can put that's comfortable. Then take the shoulder. Then it moves far less. Adding to that a tiny bit of side bending and local pressure on the segment, then the force needed is very small. And the same in the neck, really. You've got the neck in position. If you rotate it 50%, side bend it 10%, compress between the hands, side shift to the side you're manipulating, put the head in very slight extension, and then abduct that finger behind the vertebra. Everything is very tight, and the segment sometimes will go as you're preparing it. You don't need the levers.
So some of the things that you're mentioning about adding different levers and combining all of them together, some of that, or did some of that, was that some based on your understanding of biomechanics that you had from school, or are you going more just on feel and feeling tension?
That was Middleton. He introduced me to the idea of components and what they do and how you trying to bring the barrier back and make the barrier more evident. And that's why you're constantly testing. If you're going to do rotation, you gently keep it rotating while you add the other bits till the rotation becomes firm. If you're doing side bending, put some side bending, keep side bending a little as you're adding the other bits until it becomes firm. You're looking for that sense of barrier, which is not at the end of range, it's mid-range. And that's why when you're testing joints, you test them in mid-range. You never move them to the end, except looking for overall movement. You don't need that. You're getting the idea of, is there tightness within the joint? It's not at the limit of the joint. And that's Middleton's approach, and that works, no question.
Yeah, certainly. And certainly sounds like it's a much safer technique if it's not done at in-range.
Definitely. And if it fails, you won't make the patient worse. You don't get reactions with that normally.
Good. Laurie, moving on to a different topic. You teach to multiple professions, not only to osteopaths or physios, but to chiropractors, to even medical doctors as well. You're recognized across all these different professions, as far as I know, as a master of your craft, as well as an excellent teacher. In your eyes and in your mind, what makes somebody a master clinician?
I think it's being conscious of the problem the patient has, wanting desperately to help them as much as you can. The income comes secondary to that. You don't need to worry about that. That comes. It's being desperate to help people as much as you can. Even now, I'm still on the register of osteopaths, and if you're walking down the street, I have a terrible problem not to go up to people and say, I can help you with that. Sometimes you can. And I don't do it now because you often get a bad response.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to the rifle club and somebody's holding the rifle with the right hand and it hurts, I'll take hold of their wrist and I'll free it up. And immediately it's better. And I'm just squeezing that and moving it around. And he says, oh, that's better. And the trouble is then you get known for it. Everybody wants it. That's a big problem. It's nice to be up here where nobody knows me in Norfolk. That's very good.
Well, what would help or what makes somebody a great teacher? So from going through a great clinician to a great teacher, you've certainly had some important people in your life that are phenomenal teachers. What have you learned? What makes a good teacher?
I know at the School of Osteopathy, people now do a teaching course. They learn how to teach. They're taught all the mechanics of what to tell people, how to express themselves, how to direct them. I've gained that from automatic learning from just doing it. I think it'd be better to have a training thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much better at the basics. Maybe they can't do the technique, but they know how to put it over.
Yeah.
And that helps, I think. But it does become very mechanical with that, and that's the big problem.
Well, are there any particular attributes that you see in good teachers that you've learned over the years?
I've learned that there are certain places you can make things work. When they do the chest and they're trying to thrust the patient. Now, I just take a grip between the shoulder blades of the person doing the technique, just squeeze their spine there. I say, put tension there. And immediately they do that, it works.
Hmm.
What did you do? Now, all I'm doing is taking their mind off their hands, and that works. And the same with the lumbar spine. The patient's side lying, and I put my hand under their chin. I say, now do the technique, don't drop your chin. Keep the chin up, and that works. The same in the neck. With patients in position for the thrust, I say, now move the whole thing sideways, just half an inch sideways. Immediately, there's tension. Hmm. It's finding these things out, and that's 50 years of doing it. It's taught me that. It takes a while, I'm afraid. Right.
Yeah, it definitely does. Laura, you mentioned your wife earlier and all the some of the different things that she did to help your recovery from your injury. She's also good with her hands, correct? I don't remember what kind of profession she was. I want to say massage, but...
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
She was a colleague. She was working for me as a receptionist. She was very observant because she used to be a print typist. She'd print and see the mistake and pick it up. She's very accurate with that. And she started coming with me when I got divorced, my first wife, and married her on courses. She wasn't a therapist at all. She saw what I was doing and said, why did you say right foot back? That chap's got his left foot back. So she went and told him. Then he said, well, you do it. And she did it. And she found it was very easy to do following me. Then she did a course in massage, and she did very well at that. They were scared of me, but no problem. And then she came with me. She's been with me on over 300 courses in 26 different countries. So she knows exactly what she's doing. She's lightweight. She can't do the manipulation, but she knows every position, and she knows how to sort people out. And it doesn't matter who they are, she'll bully them. And she's very good at that, because if they're standing wrong, doesn't matter who they are, she'll say, come on, stand straight. And they do, and they're better with it. So she's very good at that. But she took me everywhere for treatment, to 10 different practitioners of everything to get me better. She's a real fighter.
Good. Well, yeah, that's exactly what you needed at that point, right?
Absolutely.
So you've been exposed not to just treatment, but you've also learned different approaches of osteopathy as well, right? Not just structural work?
Yes. There's all different systems, which when I was a student didn't exist in England. I qualified in 64. There was no strain and counter strain. There was no work on the viscera. There was no work on the head. There was nothing else. It was just structural work. So you have to be good at that to make it work. Now, since I've done courses with people like Magoon on the cranial work, and I've been with several American people teaching that. I've been this is one thing since the accident, my memory's bad. I can't remember people's name, but one chap who specialized in positional stuff, Lawrence Jones.
Yeah,
he came to England. I went on a course with him, and he was a very good manipulator. Then he became positional. I've also been with people teaching various different things about trigger points, all this sort of stuff. Everybody uses these things in real practice. People are now doing injections into trigger points and that sort of thing. You can do the same with your fingers. Mm-hmm. I'm still mostly a structural osteopath. But if somebody comes in, they've had a bang on the head, I work on the head. I'm not going to work on most people, but with them I do. And whatever they need, I'll throw in. Sometimes just hold and stay there and things will change. It's just being open to all that and being open to things developing. If you look at the pelvis, everybody's got a different idea. One says they go up and down. One says they go forward and back. One says they do that. Everybody's different. If you simply put a force into the joint, release it, the patient's better. And you go completely the wrong way. They're looking at positional things. I did that when I qualified. I'm not doing that now. I'm simply going for the joint and hitting that. And immediately they're better, regardless of which way you do it. This is the weird thing. I know in America you're teaching very much by position. In England we don't.
So do you apply that to the rest of the body as well, or is that mainly just the pelvis in terms of doesn't matter which way you go?
In ribs, if an upper rib, you've got to thrust it downwards because it normally goes up. The rest of the ribs, that's the first and second. The rest don't matter. In certain positions with the wrist, you move it around, you find the position, it's tight, and you just move the hands in a certain way. But mostly, I'm not looking at specific directions. I'm okay. Looking for the technique focus on the joint.
Okay. Let's see. Before I got off on that kind of tangent there, you were mentioning about your wife. It sounds like she could almost teach your courses herself.
She could. She won't do it. She won't stand up. Now, I've done some special teaching with her. As we're walking along, there's somebody walking, the chap's got a limp. I said, what's the matter with that guy? Didn't know. What's he doing? He's limping. Which leg is limping? His right knee. Where's that coming from? His knee. No, it's not his knee. That's his hip. He's not extending. Ah. Straight away, she knows that. She sees another guy limping. He's got a bad hip. Mm-hmm. And she's very good at that. Recently, my son-in-law, he phoned us up. He was in awful pain with his ankle. He came by car. He stopped outside the door. As he got out of the car, she said, he's got gout. I said, how do you know? I just know it. I've seen you with it in the past, and he's got the same wall. He came in, I examined it, and sure enough, he had gout.
Wow.
Now, he went to the general practitioner, and she said, no, it's a sprained ankle. Have these pills. They didn't work. We had some old gout pills. They cleared it up. She was right. As soon as he put one foot to the floor, she's very good at that.
Wow.
Very good.
Well,
but I can't teach a group that. I've got to teach individuals. And that gets expensive.
Yeah, it would. Well, that just says a lot about actually paying attention and continually learning, going back and that's, continually learning.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned earlier in regards to her that she knows the technique and can correct others on technique, but am I correct in what you were saying about her size doesn't allow her to perform the technique as well? Is that true?
She's never trained in the action necessary to manipulate. She can get tension on any joint by focusing. She does know the movement to make it sharp, to be effective.
So more the speed.
And she'll treat me because she's not scared of me. So she'll get things right and she'll focus, no problem. Most things. Lumbers are tricky because I'm bulky and she can't do that. But most other parts she can treat quite well. And if I say it's safe to thrust, she'll do it. And it works usually. And she's got good posture, so she's there. But she won't do this with practitioners. She's a bit scared of them from that point of view.
Okay. Along those same lines, for clinicians, whether they're male or female, that don't have the size that you or I might, or somebody like Bill, do you have any advice for them in terms of making their technique effective without using as much force? Is that just where the whole minimal leverage comes into play and feeling tension?
I think minimal leverage is important because you focus forces without putting a lot too much force into the patient. But the key to that is developing strength. If you take a small person, get them to throw a ball, they won't throw it hard. If they do it like a baseball player, with one foot back, big twist, use the other arm, they then get the distance. And the big problem with women is they haven't got the confidence to go through with a sharp stop. The key is the sharp stop so that the force goes into the patient. It doesn't stop. They're very gentle. And it's right to be gentle, but you've got to be forceful with that gentleness and apply the force with a sharp stop. That's the trouble. Once they get that, sometimes I slap their face and say, come on, do it. And and then they're there. But you've got to be very crude to them to make them do that. And I say, come on, get angry, go on. And then they do it, and it works. I say, now, get angry in future.
Just not too angry when the patient's in front of you.
No, and the problem is most men, I've got to be very cautious because they'll use too much force.
Right.
I say get angry and they do hit too hard.
Yeah. Because, as I mentioned before, because you teach to different professions, again, whether they be osteopathy, physiotherapy, chiropractic, I enjoy history. I love to learn history. Because manual therapy or manipulative therapy goes back to even ancient civilizations, do you see any similarities, because you teach to so many different professions, do you see any similarities or differences between these professions? And if so, what would they be?
I think they are different. The old manipulators used a lot of force. They wound people up and they hit them really hard. And they were very tough in those days. They could do that. Today, if you did that, you wouldn't be very popular. But if you get good results and you're not hurting people, fine. And they did learn, but they were very crude about what they did. And Cyriax, for example, a very good manipulator, he learned from his grandfather, who was a natural manipulator. So that's why his manipulation is so severe. That's what he learned. He didn't learn the fine stuff. And when he found what we were doing at the BSO, he actually became quite cooperative in his last year or so. Very strange. He didn't like us before that. But I've found that the easiest people to teach are osteopaths, providing they're not too experienced. The next are chiropractors, because they're very good at the manual therapy. They learn the different positions and they're very good. The last are physicians, because they know what's going on. They don't care if the patient's unconscious, fine, but they're going to hit them pretty hard. That's the big problem. And even somebody in the street, I can show them what to do, and they're very good. They don't know what they're doing, and they've got no medical background, but they can learn because they've got nothing else to think about. They're just doing what they're shown, and no problem. I can show somebody how to manipulate the thoracic spine. If they listen to what I say, within 10 minutes, they're doing it very well. But the complex thing is teaching somebody who has background knowledge and is trying to modify. That's the big problem.
Right, that's something that I've seen before too. And when I'm helping students, I sometimes tell them, "Look, I can teach a monkey to do what we do. It's learning the background information, learning when it's right to do it, who to do it on, and when not to. That's the important thing."
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Laurie, you mentioned Cyriacs. Did you have any other interactions with him in England?
When I was a student, we went to watch him. He was performing at a big hospital in central London. And somehow he got wind of the fact we were there. And he said, you can stay for this session, but don't you ever come again. I don't want students of osteopathy here.
Wow.
And he wouldn't have anything to do with us then.
Wow. And
but 30 years later, he was a bit more cooperative.
Yeah, and you said he got wind of what you were doing at the BSO and learned a little bit from that?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Moving along to some different things regarding you and I use the word legacy, but what you would leave behind. If there's any particular thing that you would like to be remembered by after you're done teaching, or if people are not able to take a course from you, would there be anything in particular?
Multiple components, minimal leverage, willing to be very cooperative with what the patient wants, and desperate to get them better. That's the key things. I've had two or three people I've taught over the years who were very good, and I saw them as students, picked them out. One in particular, Daryl Herbert, he worked with me. He's now in every country there is, all over the world. He's a lovely guy, and he's very good because he's taken what I've done and he's gone further with it. And I know that he's made lots of videos, and he's demonstrating 15 different countries. It's gradually spreading. He's been to Australia, New Zealand, everywhere, wow. Same as I am. So he's good. Jerry Gajada Singh was another guy. He sounds very West Indian. His father was from Bahamas. His mother was Irish. He's half and half. He's a brilliant guy as well. There's lots of people like that who are superb. And if you get a chance to see them, you'll see what I do, but modified to suit them, which is fine. People are modifying.
Wow. And can you say their names one more time?
Yes. Daryl Herbert. And Jerry Gajada Singh, it's a big name.
Okay.
They're both very good manipulators.
Wow, well, thank you for that. We'll definitely look them up.
Yeah.
If you could challenge people within the manual therapy world to do something or be something or change something, would there be anything in particular that you can think of that you would do, you would challenge them to?
To try and reduce the force in what they're doing. If we can treat people without force, you're not going to cause injuries and problems. The trouble is, if they're using force and it works, they'll carry on using it. To modify people high up is very difficult. And that's why I'm quite happy at demonstrations to show what we do. And people say, you can't do that, but I do. Mm-hmm. And if you see that, you know it does work.
Okay, good. Laurie, I haven't mentioned your book yet, so I certainly apologize for that. I've gotten off on all these different topics. But for listeners out there, if they were to go to lauriehartman.co.uk, and Laurie is spelled L-A-U-R-I-E. That is his website. And on there you'll find his book, which is called Handbook of Osteopathic Technique.
Sure.
And also a set of DVDs, which goes in tremendous detail with, I think, each and every technique within the book.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book itself? And, how did you make the decision to write a book?
Well, at the time I was teaching at the BSO, and after about 10 years of that, I suddenly thought, this is crazy. I'm saying the same thing over and over. I could put this in a book and they could use it. Nobody produced a book. So we went on holiday to Spain, and I sat typing things out. My wife sorted that out. And then we spent 4 days at the BSO taking lots of pictures of me working on that with every procedure, with me talking through it, which I couldn't do now, but then I could. Mm-hmm. And And that was a useful way of putting down what I was doing. And I published in and still making a reasonable profit on it. So it's half the price it was. It's about £30, $45, which is more reasonable. And the videos that we were seeing in the, you know, watching the film, I said, we could do this on video. So I then started making the videos, which was also 4 days of filming and lots of pictures done. And that's the same. And I've added one since on general handling specifics on that as well. So there's 8 videos, there's 9.5 hours of information on those, a lot of stuff for people to use.
And can we purchase that new video on your website, or is that, because I haven't seen that on your website?
The videos are there on the website. If you look up, as you said, lauriehartman.co.uk, you can buy the videos there. Okay. There's 7 videos in the set, and the price on those has come down because I've found somebody will make them much cheaper now. They're £50 a set, which is about $68, something like that.
Yeah.
A set of 7 videos.
Well, listeners, if you have that little amount of money, considering the value that it is, please go to his website and purchase those, because, one, they're invaluable for the information they give. Two, the quality is very good. I've directed some people to buy your book, Lori, and they bought it from a different website like Amazon, and it's not the same quality. So go to his website. Don't get it from other places. You'll get a higher quality product for that reason. Thank you. So we did a little plug for your website and your book. And your videos, for that matter.
Thank you.
I wanted everybody to know that, to know how they could learn more from you or learn more about you. I know that courses for you are not specifically advertised by you.
No.
If anyone wants to reach out to you to learn more from you, how could they do that?
Well, the problem is, if people want to come and learn, they're welcome to come to where I now live in Norfolk. But I'm now 73, 74 coming up. Really, most people have stopped by my age, so I'm not taking people for learning. I'm doing about 10 or 12 courses a year in lots of different places. And if they can get on those, I can send them a list of who to contact, but you've got to be pretty fast because they do get booked up, unfortunately.
Right.
We've got a maximum of 24 people on a course, because more than that, I just can't supervise.
Of course.
I can do 60, 70, but I'm standing on a chair, that's crazy. it's not going to work then.
Well, before you officially retire, maybe I can host you out in the States again.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about next year. This depends on my wife. She didn't come with me on this last trip. Okay. If she does, then I'm happy to come.
Okay, well, great. Lori, thank you again for your time. Is there anything else that you'd like to pass on to listeners as we're wrapping up here?
Not really. If they can use the minimum force, maximum number of components, and be aware that it can be done.
Great. Well, thank you again. I certainly appreciate it. It's great to speak with you again, and I hope to see you again in the future.
Right. Okay. Thank you.